It's game time.
Quiet, please. I am analyzing.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Is the next step the transplantation of the human brain?
Ballsy. Stupid, but ballsy.
Stand by for action.
Welcome to the party, pal.
Okay.
Remember, we're not dealing with an intelligence on our own level.
Bring in the logic probe!
Ooh!
End of line.
This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven podcast, and I had a good chance to sit down and talk with Mr. Chris Premis from Green Ronin Publishing. Now, really, he needs no introduction. Anyone who's listened to this show knows that we're big fans of Green Ronin Publishing and what they have put out in the past and what they're putting out in the future, of course. So, I mean, big news, obviously, is the Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition is on everybody's mind, especially ours. So I was able to get Mr. Premis to appear on the show and sort of talk to him a bit about his past as a gamer, his past as a publisher, and really sort of his creative process as a game designer and as owner of a company that's now 10 years old. So a company that came out of the D20 boom and has managed to have some staying power and get itself a really good reputation. So sit back and enjoy.
This podcast is brought to you by FRP Games, an online retailer specializing in all kinds of gaming products. Please visit www.forplenetwork.com in order to gain access to thousands of unique items available only at FRP Games.
This is the Forple Network.
This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven podcast, and I'm here to tell you about CantCon. For those of us who can't con, there's CantCon. CantCon will be held at the Johnson County Community College Regnier Center in Overland Park, Kansas, in the Capitol Federal Conference Room on July 9th through the 11th between 8 a.m. and 10 p.m. There will be RPG events, board game events, card game events, miniatures, games, as well as open gaming tables for impromptu sessions. Pre-registration is open currently, and if you pre-register, you'll receive an additional chance to win swag at CantCon. We have over $2,500 worth of prizes to give away over the course of the convention, and we hope to give it all away. In addition, if you pre-register, you can get a 3-day pass for only $25. If you're only interested in coming one day at a time, you can for only $10 a day. There will be registration available at the door, but you'll have less of a chance to win free prizes that way. Join us at Johnson County Community College for CantCon on July 9th through the 11th, from beginning at 8 a.m. daily. Visit www.cantcon.com for more information.
Stand by for action.
Gamers Haven Special Edition.
This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven podcast, and I have the pleasure of sitting here with Mr. Chris Premis. Now, is it Premis or Premis?
It's Premis.
Premis, okay, just like it's Green Ronin. Okay.
That's right.
But I'm
the
sure
easy way to remember that is that it rhymes with famous.
Hey, there you go. Premis famous. I will remember that. Now, Chris Premis, of course, is the owner-operator of one of the, I would say, one of the best gaming companies out there. Anyone who's listened to our show knows that we at least mention you guys once an episode, and that's Green Ronin Publishing. So,
well, thank you.
Welcome to the show. It's been a little while since we had a chance to speak with you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem. I'm glad you could find some time in your schedule to talk to me. It's obvious you guys have been very, very busy lately.
Yeah, a little bit busy.
What with all the licensed stuff you guys have been doing and the Origins nominations you managed to have garnered. So we also are crossing our fingers for some any nods your way as well. So.
Yeah, well, I sent them a lot of stuff, so
excellent.
The judges will enjoy at least some of it.
Oh, they usually do. You guys have quite the history of any awards.
Yeah, well, the Ennies, I don't know, they're sort of like our home awards. You know? we always go to the ceremony, and we have a lot of affection for EN World as a community. So, yeah, it's always fun.
Excellent. That's something that's nice about Green Ronin is you guys have always had a very good connection with your fans.
Yeah, well, I mean, our hobby is such that... you know, it's and technology is such that it's not too difficult to interact with online communities and so on. And I mean, it's just part of being a gamer is talking to other gamers. So it's sort of an extension of just doing what we love, I guess.
Sure. Well, speaking of being a gamer, let's go way back to the beginning. You know, back when the proverbial dinosaurs were roaming the earth. What got you into the hobby? What was the first game that you tried out?
Well, it was D&D. So my mother had read an article. I was like 10 years old at the time. She had read an article in a magazine about this game that crazy college kids were playing on their campuses called Dungeons and Dragons. And I was already reading Tolkien and, you know, was big into fantasy and sci-fi.
Sure.
So she thought that something that my brother and I might like. And so I lived in grew up in Massachusetts. And so we went to Salem, Massachusetts, and went to this hobby store called Eric Fuchs. Mm-hmm. And we got a copy of the white box D&D set.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then we tried to make sense of that, which was challenging.
Yes.
For, you know, if you're 10 years old and you've never role-played before. That basically led us down the path of D&D. So we ended up getting the basic set and then the AD&D Player's Handbook sort of in short order. And that was really the start of it. And from there, once I started playing D&D, I started getting Dragon Magazine. And sure. It was Dragon that sort of opened my eyes to the wider world of hobby gaming. Mm-hmm. Because this was like way before Dragon became sort of a house organ that was only about TSR stuff.
Sure.
So they had articles about all sorts of things and ads for... you know, all sorts of games and all this and that. And so that's, you know, I started playing Avalon Hill games because I read mm-hmm. Dragon Magazine, you know.
Right.
So, there was much fewer divisions, I guess, in the hobby back then than there are today, I think.
Excellent. Well, moving on, how did you get actually into the industry itself? Started writing and doing that sort of thing?
Yeah, I started as a freelance writer, and I was in graduate school when I started getting my stuff published, and mm-hmm. it basically, it was a lot of hustle, more or less.
Right.
Trying to get your first jobs, you know, those were the sort of toughest hurdles to get over because you had nothing to show anyone, like, oh, yeah, so I published for this game or that game or whatever.
Sure.
And, it, you know, the internet was around, but it was, you know, this was the early 90s and it wasn't the tool that it is today.
Right.
So
yeah. I remember those days.
Yeah. So really, you know, what it broke down to was me doing a lot of footwork at Gen Con. And so, because basically everyone in the industry goes to Gen Con, more or less. And so it was just going and talking to people and lining up work and, you know, once... you get a few jobs under your belt, then, you know, it gets easier to get work. And, mm-hmm. And as a freelancer, if you can hit deadlines, you can get work. Basically, if, you know, if word gets around, you can write and you can hit a deadline. You can get work. So that's how I got into it.
So what was the first thing that you worked on?
The first thing I worked on was professionally was it was two books for the Underground RPG.
From Mayfair?
From Mayfair, that's right. It's Ray Wininger's game. And so I wrote a bunch of stuff that was in the Underground Player's Guide and the Companion.
Yeah, that's a game a lot of people don't remember. It's was one of the last role-playing games that Mayfair put out, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it was a hoot. I mean, the whole the whole background and story of that game is hilarious. And you know, it's what's funny is, and I still joke about this with Ray Wininger, who, although I didn't know Ray at the time that I was actually writing this stuff. Uh-huh. Since then, Ray's become one of my best friends. He lives here in Seattle now and works for Microsoft. that's funny. But anyway,
funny knowing Underground.
Yeah. There's all this stuff in Underground that at the time seemed really over the top satire. Mm-hmm. And over time, reality has gotten closer to Underground, you know. And so there's things that have happened politically and socially in the last 10 years that you think might have very well appeared in Underground as a joke, except they're not a joke.
So. Right. Yep. I think the chief thing I remember out of Underground was Rush Limbaugh was a vice president at some point.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, well, you know, and they had the popular alcoholic beverage Estro Gin.
Yes, which Estro Gin. That's right. Yep.
If you were a guy, it also gave you man boobs. So.
Yep. Yep. That was an interesting game.
Yeah, I have a lot of fondness for it.
I had a copy of it, and I never got to play it myself. So. But from there, you obviously went on to do a few other things. Now, I spotted this, and the only reason I really remember this was before it was Green Ronin Publishing, it was it actually Ronin Publishing?
That was my first attempt at a company.
Okay.
So I started that company in the middle 90s mm-hmm. with my old friend Neil and my brother.
Right.
Decided he's mostly my brother mostly does politically oriented stuff, but uh-huh. for some reason he decided to go back to gaming for a brief period, and we tried to do a company together, and you know, it was a good learning experience, but it was not a successful company. Sure. And so
I do have one of the Ronin Publishing books over on my gaming shelf, and it is Feng Shui Blood of the Valiant.
Yes, indeed.
Our listeners would be, it would be remiss if I didn't actually talk about Feng Shui, at least with you, because you've done a few things with them, haven't you? With that system.
Yeah, so when that game first came out, this company called Daedalus was mm-hmm. publishing it, I wrote an adventure for them. It was in an anthology called Marked for Death.
Mm-hmm.
And then they contracted me to write Blood of the Valiant. And I wrote the book and turned it in. And then Daedalus started having all sorts of problems.
Right.
And so they were basically sort of spiraling towards their death splash.
Right.
But before they sort of, you know, slipped under the waves, I managed to make a deal with Jose Garcia, who was the guy who ran the company,
mm-hmm.
To let Ronin Publishing publish Blood of the Valiant under license. Mm-hmm. And so, that way it wasn't sort of consigned to Oblivion. So we published that book. The trouble was, by the time it came out, Daedalus had gone out.
Yeah.
And distributors could not buy the core book anymore.
Right.
So we were trying to sell them a supplement for a game that they could not buy
mm-hmm.
At that moment in time. So later, Atlas picked the lineup, and then we sold, or I guess there was no we at that point. I sold the rights to Atlas, and they republished Blood of the Valiant
mm-hmm.
A few years ago. So it's back.
Yep, I have that copy as well, actually. So, you know, I'm a completist that way, like any good gamer.
Indeed.
After your first attempt with Ronin Publishing, did it ever actually officially just die and then you went on to something else? Or did you always have that going on in the background there?
Well, yeah, it did basically officially die. So while that was going on, I moved to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And so for a while there, Neil was back in Massachusetts, and I was here in Seattle. And about 6 months after I moved here, I got a day job, and my day job was working at Wizards of the Coast, writing D&D. So it was basically over the ensuing, I don't know, year and a half or whatever, that Ronin sort of went through its last gasps. Mm-hmm. And then in 2000, when I had been working at Wizards for 2 years at that point, mm-hmm. that's when I decided to start another company, and that's how Green Ronin started.
Mm-hmm. And what's the significance of the name, the Green Ronin?
So back when we were Ronin Publishing, mm-hmm. we had this idea that each of the primary members of the company would take an email address that was a different color of Ronin. So I was the Green Ronin. And then, of course, what ended up happening is that neither of the other two followed the pattern. So in the end, it was pointless. But by that point, I was Green Ronin. And so when I was starting a new company, I was trying to come up with a name that, you know, I didn't want to be Chris Premis Games, because I'm not sure. The sort of person who'd do that. But I wanted something that, you know, for people in the industry, they would sort of know that it was my company. Mm-hmm. So I had been on all sorts of industry mailing lists under the Green Ronin email handle. So I figured if I named my company that, that was sort of my wink and nod at my game industry peers to be like, mm-hmm. yeah, this is my new company. So,
And you said you started that back in, was that 2000?
2000, yeah.
So this would be the 10-year anniversary for Green Ronin then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
I know. Crazy, huh?
How does it feel to look back at 10 years of Green Ronin Publishing then?
Well, it's funny because when we started, I sort of committed to do like two products. We were first game was called Orc, the role-playing game, which is a beer and pretzels game that I did with my friend Pod Miller. And so we had planned to do that, and then Death in Freeport, which was you know, one of the very first D20 mm-hmm. releases. But I didn't know how that was going to go. I mean, you know, I thought that we might be able to make some money selling adventures for third edition D&D, but the whole open game license, the whole D20 thing, that was all, you know, just theoretical at that point. So
right.
For all I knew, you know, we were going to put out two books, no one would care, and then that would be that. So to actually have survived for 10 years in the hobby game market, you know, it's I feel like it's an accomplishment. So I'm pleased that we are still around.
Excellent. Now, the with Green Ronin Publishing, it's obviously started 10 years ago. You guys have managed to build quite a name for yourself and quite a reputation as a very quality company that does not only D20 products now but other things. Really, what was your how did you what are your thoughts on that as far as how you've managed to build that?
Well, basically, we've always tried to take care to release quality products. And, you know, there was a point during the whole D20 mania mm-hmm. where some companies were just, well, frankly, crapping out products as fast as they could,
right.
you know, just to make more money. And, you know, we really tried to make sure that we put out good books, you know, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically people noticed. I mean, you know, that we consistently put out good books, and so that helped us build a reputation. And once we started to build the reputation, that opened up more opportunities for us. You know, basically the Green Ronin, I mean, I didn't really think of it at the time as like building up the brand name of the company, but that's basically what happened. Mm-hmm. It's and that led us to things like doing Dragon Age and so on. Mm-hmm. So it was a good way to go, I think. And mm-hmm. And having started the company not as a businessman per se, but as a game designer, I mean,
sure,
you know, no game designer wants to put out bad games.
Oh, right. Now, as I said earlier, we talked with Steve Kenson not just a few weeks ago. Obviously, Mutants and Masterminds 3rd edition is coming out, and the 1st edition came out way back in, I believe it was 2002.
That's right.
According to Steve, he said he was that you were the one who talked to him about doing a D20 superheroes game. First of all, I'm curious as to what your side of the story is.
I believe we have the same side, but so basically, way back when, Steve had written a city source book, and it was meant to be a companion city to San Angelo, which was a city book that Gold Rush Games had done for Champions. Mm-hmm. And so San Angelo is like a West Coast city, and Steve, he had designed what was supposed to be the sort of East Coast counterpart to San Angelo. Mm-hmm. But after finishing it, then Gold Rush started having some difficulties, and then, you know, their publishing schedule became erratic, and, you know, basically at this point they're, I'm not even sure what they're up to now. So, but anyway, at a certain point, Steve realized that they weren't going to publish his city book. He and I were both on this sort of private industry mailing list that was just basically a place where professionals would just kind of shoot the shit about game stuff. And so he was talking one day about how it's kind of a bummer that he had done all this work on this city book and he didn't really have anywhere to publish it.
Right.
So I just said, well, hey, Steve, if you design a D20 superhero game, then I'll publish your city book. And so that's really how it started, just sort of this kind of happenstance interaction that we had. And so Steve had written a couple of D20 books for us already. He had done the Shaman's Handbook and I think the Witch's Handbook by that point, and done a great job. It was just incredibly professional. Steve really writes the best proposals that I've ever seen in the game industry. Get a proposal from Steve and you know exactly the book that you're going to get.
Right.
Yeah, that's how it started. And then, you know, at first the idea was just sort of adapt the D20 core to Supers. And then the more Steve got into the design process, the more it became clear that there are going to have to be some pretty fundamental shifts from D&D to make those rules work as a Supers game. And so during the design process, Steve would ask me, like, well, if it's a case of sticking to how D&D does it or doing the genre right, what should I pick? And I was like, do the genre right, because, you know, we've seen already attempts to do D20 Supers, you know, that didn't and it didn't
right.
work. And so that's how ultimately M&M really kind of took on its own identity and became its own game, to the point that when we put out Mutants and Masterminds, it did not bear the D20 logo at all. We decided to make it a standalone game and just use the open game license.
Mm-hmm. Was it the first OGL game?
If it wasn't the first, it was second. I think maybe one of White Wolf's EverQuest game maybe was, but I don't totally remember, I gotta admit. So, but yeah, it was one of the very early games, because up to that point, the sort of accepted wisdom of the D20 third party was that you needed the logo, and you know, we decided that we didn't.
So. Sure. And running a company through obviously that glut of D20 products that came out, what's your take on how the market and how the industry has changed in the last 10 years?
Well, basically, I mean, tabletop role-playing games have overall, you know, been in a decline since the middle 90s.
Mm-hmm.
D20, you know, basically for a few years, like, reversed that trend, but it was a temporary spike. And so, you know, there was all of a sudden a lot of excitement, a lot of money that flowed through the system. But then, of course, once people were making money, you know, more and more companies jumped into it and more product got put out, and it was unsustainable. So yeah, it was really just a matter of time before, you know, before things began to revert to the way mm-hmm. they had been. And a lot of companies went out of business or shrunk or, you know, off of different areas or whatever. So now, you know, there are some companies that were, you know, fairly prominent in the D20 days that are totally moribund or, you know, out of business entirely. Mm-hmm. And so basically we're sort of back to where we were, you know, before the D20 boom, which is that, you know, it's publishing tabletop role-playing games in the traditional way is a harder and harder thing to do. Mm-hmm. Now there's new opportunities, you know, with the new media,
sure.
print on demand and PDFs and all that stuff. But, you know, it's difficult to do the more traditional model.
Sure. And what's your take on PDF publishing?
Well, we do it, and so yes, PDFs are a major part of our business now, and you know have been for some years, and so you know we find it's certainly a very useful part of our business, mm-hmm. And we find it especially good because it allows us to get products out. Get more eyes on them and then fix any mistakes that pop up before they're enshrined in print forever. So, mm-hmm. so it helps ensure a better final product
sure.
because certainly we use editors and proofreaders and whatever, but there's really no substitute for having hundreds of people look at something. So.
Sure. Well, let's sort of switch gears a little bit here and talk about you as a game designer. You obviously just because you run a company doesn't mean that you still don't get your feet wet and get your hands dirty doing some game design and still writing obviously tons of stuff.
Not exactly tons, but I.
I well, do. Looking at the list of credits to your name, you know it is a ton of stuff, but. But Green Ronin has, especially of late, become very entrenched in a lot of very major licenses. Probably one of the big ones, and obviously it was one of the five top-selling RPGs of the last quarter, I believe, was Dragon Age, the role-playing
That's
game.
Right.
Yeah. Who's... who you neglected to put your name on the front cover of, I remember.
I know. I know. I realized that too late in the process. But.
what can you tell us about how that came about, the Dragon Age role-playing game? Was it something you guys started, or was it something that BioWare started?
It was BioWare. So they contacted us and asked if we'd be interested in doing a tabletop RPG that tied into their upcoming fantasy game. And so basically, yeah, I mean, we're all huge BioWare fans anyway. And
sure.
when they said to us that basically it was the spiritual successor to Baldur's Gate, I said, sold. it just seemed like a great opportunity. And particularly, I thought a great opportunity to do like an introductory style RPG.
Mm-hmm. How did you go about tackling a fantasy role playing game that wasn't Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, I looked at first of all what I knew about the computer game,
mm-hmm.
And you know one of the ironies of the tabletop game is that I was basically done designing. Set one of the tabletop game before I ever got to play Dragon Age Origins. So I was doing my design based off of documents, and I went up to BioWare and I met with a bunch of the people up there and took a bunch of notes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I basically sort of looked at what they did, and then I was going to be a class and level game because that's what the computer game is. So of course, you know, D&D invented the class and level RPG.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways it was thinking about, you know, what I thought worked and didn't work about various editions of D&D and then looking at what BioWare was doing and then, you know, just basically using my own design instincts for what I thought were some good ideas for a more streamlined system that would be easy to learn and teach.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any challenges in adapting a video game to an RPG, to a tabletop RPG?
Well, there were some, but in a way, it was easier than doing a literary property because it was the intellectual property I was working with was designed to be a game property, and so, you know, oftentimes when you're dealing with other properties, the authors or the creators, you know, they're not thinking in terms of role-playing games, but BioWare, obviously, you know, that was their number one concern, was to create a good gaming environment. So, so it was easier in that sense. The tough stuff is taking things in a computer game that the computer can do in the background, and deciding how you're going to represent that on the tabletop in a way that's easy to use. Mm-hmm. So that's why, like the computer game uses like a percentile based systems with all sorts of modifiers for this and that and the other thing.
Right.
And, you know, if I tried to take that system, it would have been insane. You know?
We're not computers.
Right. It would have made Rollmaster look easy, you know? So that's why, you know, our resolution mechanic is totally different than what they use.
Right. Speaking of the mechanics of the game, and just to be clear to our listeners, it's not a D20 game. You actually use your own engine in the game. And the name of it now escapes me, and it's not, and the box isn't in front of me to look at. But what can you tell us about the mechanics of the game?
So it uses 3D6 for task resolution, so basically, you know, you've got a bunch of core abilities, and most things in the game you just handle by throwing 3D6, adding them together, adding your ability. You might have what's called a focus, and that will add 2, basically. And then you're either an opposed test or you're going against a static target number. What sort of funked it up a little bit is the stunt system that I came up with, where when you're rolling the dice, you roll 2 dice of one color and 1 dice of a different color, and that different colored die is called the dragon die. Mm-hmm. And you use that for a couple of things. It can measure your sort of degree of success. So if you roll a successful test and you get a 1, you sort of you just managed to do it. If you rolled a 6, then you did it really well. But it's also used for what are called stunt dice, and in combat when you're making attacks. If you hit and you get doubles on any of the dice, then you get stunt points equal to the result of the dragon die. So if your dragon die came up a 4 and you got doubles, and you get 4 stunt points to spend on a little menu of stunts, and stunts let you do things like, you know, move yourself or move the other guy, do extra damage and that sort of thing. So it's sort of like a dynamic critical hit system, and that's one of the things that makes combat more interesting than just a sort of punch and Judy type of thing.
Sure. Now, speaking a bit more on actual game design and game mechanics, when you're sitting down to start on a project, if it's a project like Dragon Age or really any kind of project, where do you find yourself generally starting off?
I have a period that can be a few days or in some cases a few months, depending on the project, where I do a lot of sort of research and thinking and sort of percolation, where depending on the project, the research might be direct, like Dragon Age, it was learning about Ferelden and, you know, the larger Dragon Age world and so on. Right. With other projects, it might be more indirect, just like studying up on a genre, or, you know, like if I was going to work on something for a Western, I might go look at, you know, old Western RPGs I have in my collection and whatever. And basically, ideas sort of percolate in my subconscious, and at a certain point, they kind of bubble up to the top, and then I can kind of start going. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could control that process a little better, but to know more reliably when the ideas were going to be done percolating. But,
sure.
That's how it goes. So then I start down it. I start doing the actual design. Mm-hmm. I'll usually start with an outline of what I'm doing. Start working on bits and pieces and filling it in, and then go from there.
Mm-hmm. Now with obviously the different licenses you guys have been working on, Dragon Age and Wild Cards and the Song of Ice and Fire, of course. Have you? And that's a not a overly new thing with Green Ronin, because you've also done licensed things in the past. What can you tell us that's either different or that's unique to the working with licensed products?
Well, I mean, what's different about it is that you're working in somebody else's sandbox. Mm-hmm. So when we do our own stuff, like when we do like Mutants and Masterminds source material that's set in Freedom City, mm-hmm. Well, Freedom City, that's Steve's baby, and sure. Steve can make up whatever he wants,
Sure.
Working with George R.R. Martin, we can write all sorts of things about his world, but he's going to let us know, if we've gone too far, or if we've inferred things that aren't true or what have you. So that's really the biggest thing. Now, of course, the upside is that you get to work on some really terrific properties. I don't read a lot of fantasy epics anymore. I did a lot of that when I was younger, but at a certain point I just sort of phased out of it. And for years, friends of mine told me, "Oh, you should really read the Song of Ice and Fire books." And mm-hmm. when I finally sat down and started to read them, I was like, "Oh my God, these are great!"
Yeah.
So being able to work on a property, it's done by someone who's really a master of mm-hmm. the fantasy genre. That is a treat.
Excellent. Now, with these different licensed products you guys have been dealing with, is there a particular one that proved more of a challenge to you as a writer or as a really as the owner of a company or a developer or anything like that than the other?
Well, see, now you're asking me to badmouth one of my licensors. Every license has its challenges.
Sure.
I mean, one of the big things is that role-playing games, in the overall scheme of things, are basically peanuts mm-hmm. to most other industries.
Sure.
So, like, the money that BioWare is going to make off of our RPG is a rounding error, compared to the 3 million plus units,
right.
It's more than that now, of Dragon Age that they've sold. So you can demand a certain amount of attention from someone because you're in business together.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're working on something and they can't get to you right away, like, you just have to grin and bear it because, mm-hmm. No one's going to go out of business because an RPG book came out 2 months late.
Sure. Were there any challenges creatively, though, as far as developing the product or developing any of the licensed products, sort of getting that first impetus to start the product? And I'm not talking about the interaction with the licensee type of thing. Do you find it hard to play in another sandbox, as it were?
Not really. I mean, I think that most role players are sort of used to it because when you're just like Joe Gamer, you may be playing in a homebrew or what have you,
sure.
but you're almost certainly going to have experience playing in some other setting like Greyhawk or mm-hmm. the World of Darkness or whatever it is. So as a publisher, it's sort of similar to that, except that unlike a home campaign, mm-hmm. there's someone that you have to submit your work to who's going to say, yes or no.
Sure. And you use that experience to help you when you're writing.
Yeah. And really, I mean, creatively, we haven't had great difficulties with any of our licensors.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I mean, at worst, we've worked with some people who were didn't really understand what we were doing, mm-hmm. but that was okay because they didn't feel the need to stick their fingers in either.
Sure.
So, we'd rather have a sort of, not indifference, but, if you don't really know what we're doing and don't, aren't don't really care, you know, how we adapt the game stuff. Mm-hmm. That's actually easier for us than someone who cares too much and wants to, you know, get their fingers all up in it. Sure. But, you know, when we worked with Lynn Abbey on the Thieves World stuff, like, mm-hmm. Lynn was totally awesome, you know. She worked very closely with Rob Schwab. She came out to Gen Con you know, did signings at our booth, and Rob Schwab ran a Thieves World game and she played in it. And, you know, she was very, very much, you know, a useful and great partner to work with. So I think Lynn gets the like best licensor award. Mm-hmm. She was very much involved in the creation of the Thieves World stuff.
Sure. Whereas Dragon Age is obviously your big major release that you recently did, to my knowledge anyway. The next big release you guys have on the horizon is, of course, the DC Heroes Handbook, with powered by, of course, Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition.
Yeah, DC Adventures is...
DC Adventures, I'm sorry.
DC Heroes is the old Mayfair game.
Right, right. And the DC Heroes Handbook, I was just getting mixed up with that, so...
Oh, yeah,
right. And, of course, that's we're all, you know, waiting patiently for that, hopefully at Gen Con this year.
That is the plan.
That is the plan. and we talked a little bit about new additions and whatnot. What has been the reaction to the announcement of a new Mutants and Masterminds edition?
Well, of course, when you do a new edition of anything, mm-hmm. some people are going to approach it with caution because, you know, they want to make sure that the game you're selling them is the game that they fell in love with, you know? It's a challenge for any publisher because if you're doing a new edition, on the one hand, there needs to be some new things about it, because otherwise, why are you asking people to spend $40 or $50 more?
Right.
You know? But on the other hand, you know, you don't want to abandon sort of the core of what made your game popular in the first place. So, of course, there is some concern in the community, but there's also a lot of excitement about DC Adventures, mm-hmm. And you know what that means for M&M 3 and sort of, you know, the future of the game.
Sure.
I think overall the reception has been good, and we've been doing weekly design diaries on mutantsandmasterminds.com, mm-hmm. Where Steve talks about the design of the game and the choices that went into it and so on, and those have been going over very well. So.
What can you tell us about the decision to put out the DC Adventures before the actual third edition core book comes out?
Basically, we had been in talks with DC off again, on again for quite some time.
Right.
And the final impetus that made the deal happen was that this year was DC's 75th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And so they basically told us, look, you know, we want DC to be everywhere it can be, including role-playing games. And so, you know, we'd like to move ahead and make this deal. And, but because DC is owned by Warner Brothers and, you know, I mean, Warner Brothers, pretty big company,
right.
Actually going through all the stages of negotiation and then working through the contracts and all this and that, it took quite some time. And sure. So, basically we were going to be running out of 75th anniversary. So, so we decided to lead off with DC, and then do M&M later. And part of it also was, you know, there's going to be a Heroes Handbook for Mutants and Masterminds, mm-hmm. as well. And obviously M&M and DC Adventures, they're using the same system.
Sure.
So there's going to be a lot of content that is the same in both of those books, you know, mm-hmm. all the powers, how to build a character, you know, sure. all that stuff. So one of the things we decided to do was sort of do DC as the hardback book and then make M&M the softback version. So, you know, in a way to give DC the sort of prestige format. And then, you know, if there's price sensitive gamers who don't want to pony up that much, you sure. know, they could wait a few months and M&M, and you can still use M&M 3 with the DC character books,
sure,
or
sure.
what have.
Okay, excellent. And that sort of reminds me a bit about the pocket guides you guys put out.
Mm-hmm.
What was the impetus of putting pocket guides out? Something similar?
Yeah. Well, so the idea was to basically do something to encourage players to buy in. Like a lot of times, the GM will get a copy of a core book. You know, he'll spend the $40 or whatever on it, and then that one core book will be used to run a game for six people, and you know, the players actually never like buy into the line really.
Sure.
And so we thought if we did these players' guides that had all the information that the players needed, but you know, remove the GM information, and then did them in a smaller format in black and white for a low price point, this would encourage players. So, you know, we did the Mutants and Masterminds Pocket Player's Guide. Mm-hmm. It was $20 as opposed to $40 for the full color hardback core rulebook. So, we've done a couple of those. We went for True 20. That was only $15. And we're doing a pocket edition of the Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game. That's probably going to go to print like next week or so.
Nice.
But what we did this time was just to put the entire rulebook in it because we were sort of, people weren't exactly getting the difference between a pocket player's guide and a core rulebook, you know.
Right.
They didn't sort of get that it was everything in the core game except the GM material.
Right.
And, you know, that distinction was just being lost on people or, you know, they didn't think it was a rule book or whatever. So we decided for the Song of Ice and Fire one, you know, we just put everything in it. So that's coming up pretty soon. We collected up all the errata and everything and fixed that all up. So, it's also got all the most up-to-date stuff in it as well.
Excellent, excellent. Now, with obviously Mutants and Masterminds 3rd edition coming out, sort of looking into wrapping us up soon, is there anything on the horizon for Green Ronin that we should be excited about or that you personally are excited about?
Well, there's lots of stuff. We're very excited to launch DC Adventures, obviously.
And that's going to be four books, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so the license we got is four books. There's the Hero's Handbook, which is the core rule book.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're doing two big character books, Heroes and Villains, Volumes 1 and 2. DC Universe is going to be the last book.
Right.
And so then sort of overlapping with those releases is the relaunch of Mutants and Masterminds with the 3rd edition and then support books for that. So basically, you know, if you get into the game through playing DC, even after we're done with our four DC books, you can buy any Mutants and Masterminds release and that'll give you more material for your game.
Right.
So, yes, we're excited about that. I've been working on set 2 for Dragon Age, and so, you know, that'll be levels 6 to 10 for the game.
Is that going to be another box set?
Yes. The idea of Dragon Age is that it's four boxed sets,
nice.
Each of which covers five levels of play.
Obviously you did that on purpose. Is there any kind of thoughts behind making it a box set?
Yes. Well, I mean, for one thing, I just love box sets.
Sure.
As someone who grew up as a gamer in the 80s, I just have a real fondness for the format. And I think it's very, you know, it's particularly friendly to new players because you can have a separate player's book. You can include dice inside. It's easy to blow in maps and things like that.
Sure.
So you can get a nice product that way. You know, it is also a nod to the old D&D Basic Expert,
sure.
You know, et cetera series. That also is not a coincidence. It really says game to me. Splitting it up that way, it was part of the plan to do something that was friendly to new players.
Cool.
So we weren't saying, like, here, read this 300-page book, and then you can role play. You know, the player's book for Dragon Age is 64 pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lot to digest.
Sure.
And
You're talking to someone who cut his teeth on the Marvel superheroes game, so...
Oh, okay.
I know what you're talking about as far as that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, it, you know, just design wise, like, mm-hmm. you know, there was a time where a new RPG was commonly 64 pages or 80 pages right. or whatever. And, you know, over the past 20 years, it's just gotten bigger mm-hmm. and bigger. And, you know, I don't know that that's helped us as a hobby. Yeah.
Over the last 10 years, there really haven't been that many box sets that have come out. Some have come out from you guys. I think Hymenoptera is the only one that comes to mind right now, but.
Yeah, that was our previous box set attempt, mm-hmm. And you know that was us, you know, our sort of campaign setting in a box.
Sure. So obviously you got that that Dragon Age that second Dragon Age set coming out.
Yeah.
What's beyond that?
Well, first let me just pause and say that another exciting thing that just came out is the Song of Ice and Fire campaign guide.
Yes.
That just got into stores like a week and a half ago, and that's been a long time coming. And mm-hmm. you know, it's finally the companion book to the core rule book. And you know, the core rule book was pretty light on setting information because mm-hmm. it was really meant to be a rule book. And so now, you know, it's the 256 page setting book all about Westeros. Mm-hmm. So that just hit, and you know, and then just today the HBO had. Their first little trailer for the Game of Thrones TV show. So
they did.
Oh, yeah,
I'm gonna hunt that down.
It's 20 seconds long, man, but it'll make you shiver if you're a fan of the books.
Oh no, I just anyone listening to the show knows that we've quickly become fans of the books, and I hadn't read the books up until probably about 6 months ago. So, but yeah, because when Song of Ice and Fire came out, I was like, what's this? I have no idea what this is. I've read the books. I'm like, ooh.
Yeah. So, you know, after the Gen Con stuff, mm-hmm. well, so we've got an adventure collection for Dragon Age called Blood and Ferelden.
Oh, cool.
That is currently in the approvals process, but hopefully we'll be releasing that soon.
Sure.
And that's got three full-length adventures in it and then three kind of extended adventure outlines. So they're not adventure seeds. They're about 1,000 words each. So okay. they sort of... explain out a whole adventure if you want to flesh it out then.
Mm-hmm. Do that.
So that should be out soon. That should give Dragon Age GMs a little more grist for their campaign mills. And then after that will be set two. And then after Gen Con is Heroes and Villains for DC Adventures. Mm-hmm. We're doing a campaign starter for Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game. So one of the things in Song of Ice and Fire role-playing is that in addition to making a character for yourself, you also collaboratively make a noble house.
Mm-hmm.
And
ooh,
you're all members you know, somehow connected to this noble house. So mm-hmm. in addition to playing your own character, you also have the larger goals of advancing the interests of your house.
Wow.
So what the campaign starter does is it's got six fleshed out noble houses mm-hmm. that you can use in your campaign. Either if you're a GM, you know, you can use them as allies or enemies of your players' houses. Or if you don't want to make up your own house, you could just pick one of them and, you know, and mm-hmm. go. That should be out this fall. And then there's, we've got the Pathfinder Freeport Companion.
Oh, really? Excellent.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard about that one.
I think the correct title is Freeport Companion Pathfinder RPG Edition.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a 160-page book, which is basically the rules companion for the Pirate's Guide to Freeport, which itself is a systemless book. So mm-hmm. basically we did this systemless setting book, then we've done a series of these rules companions. So this is going to be the Pathfinder one. So it's got stats for the major NPCs. It's got monsters, classes, prestige classes, feats, an intro adventure, mm-hmm. and all sorts of stuff. So we had previously released a D20 Freeport Companion. So basically it's that same book, but we just updated it to Pathfinder.
Sure,
Yeah, so that's a little bit of love for our Pathfinder playing fans and Freeport fans. And nice to have something out for Freeport this summer because It's also Freeport's 10-year anniversary. So.
Oh, that's right, because you get it's the Green Ronin's 10-year anniversary, and
yeah.
Freeport was okay.
Yeah,
the gears are clicking together now.
Yep, by default.
Excellent. Is there anything else that you want to before I move on to my next question? Is there anything else on the horizon for Green Ronin that you
want? Yes, to one talk more about? Thing that I shouldn't forget is actually the last Wild Cards book. It's called Aces and Jokers, and it's basically a character collection. Mm-hmm. That's actually going to be our last book for second edition
for Mutant Master. Right.
Yeah, that should be out hopefully before Gen Con. It's a nice complement to the previous Wild Cards books.
Sure. Excellent. When was the last time that you had a chance to roll some dice, and what was it?
Role playing or anything?
Really anything.
Two or three weeks ago, I went to a convention here in Washington State called Enfilade, and it's run by the Northwest Historical Miniatures Game Society, and it's basically sort of like my local con that I go to and play miniatures games at every year. So I don't do any business there; I just go and play. And so they do 4-hour sessions there. Mm-hmm. And I went down with a couple of friends early enough, so we were there before the first session started, so I played 6 games in 48 hours, so it was 24 hours of miniatures gaming. Yeah.
What was it that you played, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't mind. I played a game called Check Your Six, which is it's a World War II air combat game. I played The Sword and the Flame, which is Larry Brom's classic sort of colonial era miniatures game. Mm-hmm. That was like an Indian mutiny scenario. I did a big Napoleonic game for this guy's own Napoleonic homebrew rules. I played a game called They Died for Glory, which is Franco-Prussian War. And what am I forgetting? I played a Flames of War game. It was France 1940. And I think there was one more, which I'm blanking on. But
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say not only are you a war game fan, but you are also a history fan.
That is correct, sir. I'm a historian by training, and I love history. Most of what I read is history. So... when I got into miniatures games, it was back in the early 80s through D&D. In fact, I got the first edition of the AD&D Battle System. That was the first miniatures game I played. So I played a lot of fantasy and sci-fi stuff over the years. But, eventually I found my way into historical miniatures, and I do more of that than anything else these days.
Well, you'll probably find it entertaining that I actually cited and used... some of the background information or the historical information in the Trojan War book you guys put out. I cited that in a history paper.
Oh, nice. When I was in eighth grade, I wrote a paper about druids, and I used the AD&D Player's Handbook as a source, and my teacher did not really look too look too kindly on that, which in retrospect, she was totally right, because it's not like D&D's a history book. But
Right.
I was in eighth grade. So.
See, at least with Trojan War, I could disguise it and just say it's this book called The Trojan War. Yeah.
Well, it's really my interest in history is why we did Vistas line. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
And I still have all of the Vistas, the historical Vista stuff you guys did. Those are wonderful books. Because I'm a huge history nut too. So.
Yeah, I was very pleased to have done the Testament and Eternal Rome and Trojan War. Those were all good books.
Mm-hmm. Now, the last question I have for you is sort of a broad one. One thing that the Gamers Haven is all about is really spreading the knowledge and love of the tabletop gaming hobby. But what is it about this hobby that you love that's kept you coming back again and again and again for 20 years?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, you know, just at a very base level, gaming is fun, and who doesn't like to have fun? but also, you know, I mean, it's intellectually stimulating, and you know, there's many different ways you can engage in the hobby. So, you know, like I like historical miniatures gaming, so that leads me to read about and discover more periods of history, or you know, learn new things about periods of history that I thought I knew a lot about, and you know, I was wrong. So there's that. There's the creative aspect. You know, I mean, I became a game designer because first I became a game master, you know? There's also just that fun you get out of building stuff and creating stuff. And it also is, you know, it's a fun way to have a good social activity with your friends, you know, that you do face to face. I spent 3 years writing for a massive multiplayer online computer game called Pirates of the Burning Sea. But I would way rather sit around my dining room table and play a role-playing game because, you know, it's nice to be in the same room with my friends. and so, you know, it's a good social activity. It builds good communities. I mean, you know, there's just lots of great things about gaming.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you, thank Mr. Primus here. Primus, famous, hey, there you go. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to talk to us over here at the Gamers Haven.
It was my pleasure.
We look forward to seeing more of your stuff in the years to come.
Well, thank you. I will be a guest of honor at Conquest BC, which is happening in Vancouver. The weekend of July 9th. So, folks who are in that area, come on down.
You paying attention now?
Yes.
All right. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone, where we don't know what we're talking
about. We do know what we're talking about. You know, we called the whole Hugo Weaving Red Skull thing, remember?
Oh, right. Fine. Where was it? The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about all kinds of gaggles.
Aaron, could you cut it with the gaggles thing? It's not working for me.
All right, fine. The Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games.
Hey, don't forget that we talk about, you know, Bruce Campbell and Christopher Lee, obviously.
Natalie Portman.
All right, guys! I'm trying to do a commercial for the Red Phone Zone, where we talk about movies, comics, video games, tabletop gamings, all kinds of other geek stuff.
You mean that show we broadcast on Ustream?
Yes!
Wednesday, 8 Central Standard Time.
Right, at redphonezone.com. Now, can you guys just give me a minute to get this promo done?
Sure, sorry, dude.
Yeah.
All right, from the top. Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone.
Aaron, we need a tiebreaker. Okay, who would win in a fight with Galactus?
Anti-Monitor.
Galactus and Anti-Monitor. Come on.
I think the more important question would be who would win in a fight between me and you two idiots.
Well, I guess we don't know what we're talking about.
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.